text that we just chanted, the key passage or the most kind of central passage as far as Dhamma is concerned is the passage that was repeated in the end part where it talks about Otirnom hi jatiya jara maranena. I'm overwhelmed. But this word otirno is like swept over or swept under by birth, aging and death. So ke hi parideve hi duke hi domana se hi upaya se hi, by sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief and despair. Dukotino dukapareto, I'm swept under by suffering and a prey to suffering. It's a nice little cheerful passage, isn't it? Thank you. Give you some zippity doo dah in the morning when you think about that one. The power of positive thinking and all that. So, of course, dukkha is this kind of irreducible fact of life, and is the great spur for our spiritual practice, our spiritual path. And the psychology presented in that particular sutta is very realistic. It's very, very straight down the line. You know, somebody, when you know, your original motivation for spiritual practice is some kind of existential crisis. And that's what it's talking about there. This is the modern word we use, is an existential crisis. But that's clearly what's being described there. And an existential crisis means a crisis or a shift of awareness, like an enlargement of awareness of one's own consciousness that takes one out of the mundane and gives one a clear and undeniable and overwhelming apprehension of the real nature of existence. And so this kind of spur to spiritual practice is not in a sense ethical. And this is something it took me quite some time to realize or to understand, but these two things are actually quite distinct, and often we confuse the two. And we say that Buddhism is a way of doing good, and this is of course how it's often presented, and of course there's some truth to that, but that's not really the essence of it. Actually, the whole thing about doing good and keeping precepts and all of those things is part of the path of practice. It's part of the way to the end of suffering. But it's not this, so it comes under like the fourth noble truth. But the first noble truth, the truth of the realization of suffering, has got nothing to do with ethics. It's an existential matter. It's about the meaning of life, or lack thereof, depending on how you want to look at it. And in that way it bears similarity, or it bears comparison with the teachings and the philosophies of the modern existentialist philosophers, and the basic kind of dilemma that was addressed by the existentialist was dramatized by very famously by Albert Camus, who wrote a novel where the character ended up walking along a beach with a gun in his hand. And he was in Algiers, and he saw a fellow in the sand, happened to be an Arab, and he just shot him, killed him. Not for any reason, but why not? What's the difference anyway? And the dilemma there, or the point is that when we're faced with the kind of the overwhelming, the immensity of existence itself, of being itself, then within that immensity, then whatever we choose to do seems something very puny, this is one of the themes of the existentialist philosophers. Our choices are very puny. Whether we choose to turn left or turn right doesn't really matter compared with the fact that we are in the first place. Whether we choose to do good or to do bad is almost irrelevant in the face of the fact that we are, we exist. And so we can only ever, within this sphere of existence, we can only ever do a variation on a theme. We can only tweak things a little bit. We can make some minor changes. But we can't ever really make any major difference to this brute fact of existence. And it's something like this crisis which is presented as being the entrance to the Buddha's teachings in this particular discourse, the Chatama Sutta. And so there's this realization, this reflection that somehow the nature of my life, or the nature of life itself, is filled with these inescapable kinds of suffering. And of course that's the depressing side, and that's the side that more or less the existentialist philosophers, the modern existentialists, remain stuck. So they basically said that life is, existence is a whole bunch of suffering, and that's all there is, so you just have to suffer. That's it. You can just, but the only respite to that, the only glimmer of hope was that at least you can suffer in French, make it sound good. That's okay then. But apart from that, there's no glimmer of hope. Whereas in Buddhism, you have that realization of the suffering, the power of suffering, the depth of it. Apevanamaman imasa kevalasa dukkha khandasa antikiriyaya panyayetati. Perhaps there may be, or could there be, may it be the case that a complete ending to this whole mass of suffering can be realized, can be made known. And so there's this little ray of hope there. So this, of course, is the sort of classic kind of psychological thing, isn't it? You remove all everything, you're sort of shrouded in darkness, yeah? And then this kind of ray of light appears, and it's phrased very beautifully. One of my favorite Dhammapada verse is, what is laughter, what is joy when the world is ever burning? Shrouded by darkness, would you not seek the light? And I always love that. That always cheers me up. So there is that hope, and there is, that realization that through our practice, through embarking on this very obscure, difficult, challenging path of Buddhist practice, that somehow we can reach an end of suffering. And of course, one of the things that happens is that the mind is not, consciousness is not stable, our awareness is not constant. So this realization, this insight into the nature of suffering, which is what drives us into spiritual practice in the first place, disappears. It doesn't stay with us all the time. And there's something about an insight which happens freshly, something which arises new in the mind, which can be very powerful. But that can't be sustained after it's repeated and so on for a long period of time. Then it tends to lose its power. It becomes mundane once more. And so it very often is the case, if not normally the case, that our personal level of insight and level of urgency around the Dhamma will diminish over time. That's the kind of the natural course of things. And so we've got this idea in our mind, you know, it's still there to some extent. That existential realization is still there to some extent, but we kind of forget about it, don't we? Gets lost, and we get distracted, and we get caught up in all the little bits and pieces of life, and you know, some of the things it talks about in the sutta, like, you know, getting worried about being able to eat what you want when you want, you know, and then that becomes more important. You know, the fact that I want to eat this now becomes more important to you than finding an ending of suffering. So we forget, we lose sight of the real reason why we've started this spiritual practice in the first place. So of course, even though the sutta is presenting, you know, the entry into the teachings in this way, of course that's not kind of universally the case at all. And it was quite interesting and a little bit disturbing for me, I have to admit, in my first rains retreat as a bhikkhu I spent at Phujongkom in Thailand, and it was a very good rains retreat. We had a nice community there and I enjoyed it a lot. But there was one time when the monks were sitting around and we were just talking about what it is that we were doing and what we aspired to and so on. And I was quite shocked to realize that actually most or just about all of the other monks actually weren't in it to win it. They were aiming for the bronze. They wanted to be a good monk, or they wanted to learn how to live a more peaceful life, or something like that. I can't remember exactly the answers they gave. But nobody said, or I can't remember, maybe somebody said, but not everyone said, I'm in it to get enlightened, I'm in it to get nibbana, I don't want to get reborn. I was quite disturbed, actually, you know, and it's kind of a sign of my own naivety that I'd got that far in my spiritual practice and in the community to actually be already lived there for a year and a half by then and taken full ordination, and not to realize that actually many or most of the people, even the other monks, were not really interested in finding an escape from suffering. And you know, these were good monks in a good monastery, and they said, I've brought this subject up again and discussed it and found the same thing in other contexts as well. And so we find that a lot of people come to Buddhism for all kinds of reasons. Maybe they just like a simple life, they're interested in learning some mindfulness, they just want a peaceful environment, or whatever it may be, many different kinds of things. And that's not good enough, actually. If you really want to practice, then your motivation has to come from a deeper place than that. And I guess it's almost superfluous to add that of those monks who we were discussing with, and you know, we had that conversation with, almost all of them have disrobed by now. Obviously, you can see the reason why. We have it's essential, absolutely essential, to keep this in mind, this root level existential problem. What are we doing here? What is this life for? What does it mean? What is the suffering of actually being? Forget the suffering of not getting the kind of coffee you want or something like that. Even that is trivial in the end. But that pain of just being, and you can solve all of your problems. You can get the best coffee, you can have the nicest place to stay, you can have in the perfect environment, all the best weather, you can have all the things that you want, and you still are, and there's nothing you can do about it. And even the Brahma gods and the devas in their formless realms and things like that, they still have this suffering of simply being, of simply existence. And existence itself is inherently stressful. There's nothing we can do about it. There's no escape inside the realm of being, inside the realm of existence. And so there's this kind of feeling, this longing, up Avanama. Could there be? I really love that. I think it's just so wonderful. You know, it's not this kind of dogmatic assertion. You know, because we're talking about somebody from who's just starting out their practice, and it's a sense of wonder that's coming up in this. This is this kind of this idiom has this kind of sense of wonder about it, and it's quite different from the perspective of the Buddha, who's speaking from his attainment of wisdom and freedom. He says, "Ati bhikkhave ajatanga bhutanga katanga sankatanga." There is monks, the unborn, the unmade, the uncreated, the unconditioned. But when we're starting out on practice, you know, we don't make that kind of emphatic statement, that kind of lion's roar. But what we have is that sense of wonder. Could it be? Could it be? Could it be that, you know, we don't have to go around in our life and patch things up all the time? That there's more to it than that. Fixing this and fixing that and trying to make this better and trying to make that better. While all the while, as long as we're fixing one thing, something else is breaking down. Could it be that there's a way of, you know, it's like pulling the rug out from under the whole problem? And this is the promise or the hope that Buddhism offers us. And so when we do our practice, what we're actually doing from time to time, from moment to moment, can be very mundane. We're brushing our teeth, we're shaking out the foot mat, we're answering the telephone, we're digging sand. These things are all very mundane, and there's nothing particularly religious about them. And so we say, well, we should do these things mindfully. But what do we mean when we say we should do it mindfully? Well, often we have this idea, I certainly have this conditioning, which I have to keep on still trying to break down from my first retreats, when I did Mahasi retreat, that mindfulness means knowing where your body bits are when you're moving your hand and where that is and where your posture is and so on and so forth. And that's what mindfulness is. But actually this is only one small part of what mindfulness is. And one of the other things which is very important is the sense of understanding the context, we call sampajanya. And the sampajanya in its highest sense, or its ultimate sense, means putting everything we do within that framework, within that existential framework of actually everything that we're doing is geared towards escape. It's geared towards transcendence. And this is the big difference between staying in a monastery and staying in, not necessarily everywhere, but in most places outside of the monastery, is that when we're here, the place is established and set up and dedicated solely for that purpose, solely for that purpose of providing an environment and encouraging an avenue for escape. That's all. That's what we're doing here. And if we can't do that, then we might as well close shop. We're not here to provide an opportunity for people to make merit. We're not here to do landscaping and have a nice environment. We're not here to kind of be relaxed and comfortable and happy and enjoy ourselves. We're not here to study the Buddha's teachings and publish books giving comparative studies on historical analysis of Buddhism and these kinds of things. We're not here to re-establish the bhikkhuni order. We're not here to do any of these things. That's all a waste of time. It's got nothing to do with spiritual practice. We're here to get enlightened. One thing only. And everything else, from brushing our teeth all the way up to establishing the Bhikkhuni Sangha and all of those things, all of that is just the means we use to employ to help us in that quest for enlightenment. That's all. And so we should never mistake the means. We should never escape the steps along the path for the actual, the context of the path and where the path is leading to. So here in this monastery, in this physical environment, we have, I think, one of the world's best and contexts for being able to really practice and really realize these stages of enlightenment. And we have the forest, we have the cave, we have the seclusion, we have the teachings, we have the supportive community, we have the requisites that have been very kindly donated to us by the lay community. All of these things are here. And for those of you who have been around a little bit and looked around the world, you know how rare this is. And even in Australia or in other countries around the world, how many places are there available to practice like this is very, very few. And so we have that tremendous sense of gratitude and appreciation towards Sister Niroda, the donor of the place here, towards all the people that have contributed funds, to all the people who have contributed their time, all the community, everything everyone's done here, all the Sangha who stayed here over the years, each one has added something of themselves here. And the end result of it is what we have right now. This is the end of all that work. It's right here, right now. And we inherit all that. What are we going to do with that inheritance? Well, how are we going to treat that? Are we going to take that for granted? Are we going to look at all of the money that's been spent, all of the time that's been put into here, and are we just going to take that as something that's very trivial and doesn't mean anything? Why is it that people have supported us here for the practice, for our practice? So we want to see an environment where people can genuinely have that sense of spiritual urgency and determination in their practice. An environment where we can maintain the rage, as they say. Maintaining the rage. How do we do that? How do you maintain the rage? How do you keep that edge in your practice? Yeah? So there are things that we can do that will help us with that. And some of the practical things we can do, one thing is spend a lot of time by ourselves, staying in seclusion. Another thing we can do is a bit of physical discomfort, and endurance is also a good thing. You know, if we get too comfortable, then we tend to get lazy. And another good thing is constantly reflecting about it, reminding ourselves of the gratitude we have for being here, the extraordinary opportunity we have, and the fact that it's all uncertain. We don't know what's going to happen. Really. We don't know what's going to happen. Yesterday the guys from the council came. They looked very nice, but maybe they're not. Maybe they're horrible monsters and they're going to close us down. Maybe there's going to be a bushfire. Everything's going to burn. Maybe there's going to be a war. I don't know. Future is uncertain. The oil is running out. I don't know what's going to happen. None of us know what's going to happen. Is the environment going to hold together? These things are all very, very uncertain. We might not have very much time. So we shouldn't take these things for granted. We should always be reflecting about them, always reminding ourselves. This is not... it's not normal. The situation we have here is not normal. It's something which does not just come about because of accident. It comes about from a long time of effort and planning and care and investment of time and money and all of those things. And it needs that energy to sustain it, like any structure. It can easily fall apart. So we need to keep that in mind and keep on giving ourselves that urgency. Another way of encouraging that sense of urgency is through reading the suttas. That gives us straight to the heart of what the Buddha's message was, and this is always what he's saying again and again and again. Jayata bhikkhave mappamadatta mavo paccha vipatisarata yango amahakam anusasanante. Do jhanas, monks. Do not be negligent. Do not regret it later. This is my instruction to you. Again and again and again. Etani rukamulani, etani sunyagarani. Here are those roots of trees. Here are the secluded dwelling places. Go and practice. Don't waste time. So these are very important ways to encourage that. Another way is through reading the stories of the great teachers. And if you read a lot of the teachers, especially the Thai forest tradition, is that this is really one of the glories, I think, of the Thai forest tradition, and the essential value of it is not so much in the content of the teaching, which you know we can find from regular Buddhist books, but the essential thing is that quality of unremitting application and dedication, which we find that spirit of authenticity that we find in those meditation masters. And so, you know, for me, this is always the main thing that I get from the Thai forest tradition. So this is also something which can be great inspiration. But leaving all of those aside, none of those things are good enough. Okay, so all of those are things we can do to help us to spark that and we'll maintain it and so on and so forth. But at the end of the day, it's just you and the chasm of your own consciousness. And you've just got to stare into that chasm for long enough until you see the blackness of it. And one of my favorite sayings from Nietzsche, if you stare into the abyss for long enough, then the abyss stares back at you. And if you don't know what that means, then you haven't practiced enough. You've got to stare into the abyss until the abyss stares back at you. What that means is that it becomes alive, it becomes real. It's not just an idea, it's not just a blankness, but it feeds back. Consciousness feeds back on itself, the contemplation feeds back on itself. Our own awareness of dissolution, of danger, of the emptiness of things, this feeds back into our mind and gives our mind more energy and more alertness, and then that feeds back into our contemplation, and round and round and round it goes, so that our consciousness feeds off and our awareness feeds off this, until we realize that it's actually fear of that abyss, fear of that suffering, fear of death, all of those things, which is what it's actually obscuring our mind in the first place. We don't want to know. There's a resistance. There's a veil. We want that veil to be there. It's nice. The veil is nice. The veil is what stops us from seeing things as they are. And you know what is that fear? I mentioned before the story of somebody who I know when we were talking about doing an 8 precept day, and when it came in, we said, okay, what are we doing for the 8 precept day? And it came to the one about not wearing makeup, and then she said, right, that's it, no way, not doing that. Hadn't been seen in public for years without a makeup, so that was the end of that. So that's right there. Is the power of ignorance. That's the power that will not see one's own true face. I am not prepared to look at my true face. I have to put makeup on it to hide it so I can see the makeup. I can't see my true face. And that right there is ignorance. That's avijja. That's the power of darkness, which is drawing that veil over the world and stopping us from seeing things as they are. And so the root of that, the heart of that, is something which comes to us spontaneously. It's something which happens at midnight in the dark when we're alone in our kuti and there's nothing. There's just nothing. And then somehow that voice will speak to us out of the darkness. The abyss will look back at us. And then we will see that which is. We'll see that which exists. We'll see the nature of that. And this will again remind us of that context, of that life, that existential crisis. So this is my little talk for you this evening on maintaining the rage. So I offer this to you for your reflection.